Good evening and welcome to Shattered Lives, a lively, educational, and issues-driven radio show designed to tell another side of the story, to focus on and humanize crime victims, to enlighten and shine the spotlight on organizations and service providers, and to assist those who walk the path with us. This is Donna R. Gore, a.k.a. Lady Justice, your host, and my co-host, Delilah Jones, president of Imagine Publicity.com, welcoming you this evening and every Saturday evening across the nation to enlighten, to educate, and to have fun with the issues that we talk about, many of which surround the aftermath of crime, sometimes health and wellness, sometimes disability, and whatever show we feel that may be of value for you. So I want to say good evening again, and thank you so much for joining us, whether you're joining us live or on the archives. It is so very appreciated. And just before I bring in my co-host, I just want to say it's been a whirlwind of activity the last couple of weeks. I'm back on my home turf in Connecticut after a very wonderful and inspiring conference at the Q Center for the Missing in Wilmington, North Carolina. And as you may know, we've kind of taken over Facebook. They serve people who are adults who go missing of any nationality, religion, creed, ethnicity, social standing, whatever. It does not matter. If you are a missing person and you choose to register, Monica Kaysan and her team will help you. And I'm proud to say that her scope is expanding in terms of state coordinators, and I have chosen to be one, so I'll try to do what I can in my little corner of the state. And it was wonderful to see my friend and my PR manager, Delilah, who is now a South Carolina coordinator. Delilah, good evening, and it was so nice to be with you these last couple of weeks. How are you?
Great, and we had a lot of fun and did a lot of work and got really tired because that conference is, as you know, jam-packed, and every minute of every day is scheduled, and it's all good. It's all very good stuff. I mean, more information, you know, the moving stories that a lot of the families of the missing have. So we really had a lot of tears, laughter, and a great time. So it was good to see you there.
Yeah, you too. Every once in a while, we have to reach out and touch in person if we can. And speaking of reaching out and touching, we have a guest that is one of my very favorites. This is her second time around. She actually agreed to come on second time, Delilah. We must be doing something right. We have Pam Ressler. Actually, her business is called Stress Resources, Inc. from the Concord, Mass. Area. She is a very accomplished woman. She is an RN by profession with 30 years' experience in healthcare. She's an instructor at the Tufts University School of Medicine and UMass Boston. She is a prolific writer and author and blogger, and has many interests in the community as well. And I just have to say that she's very much in touch with resiliency and one of my favorite topics, because I think that's one of my favorite things to discuss. But tonight we're going to get into something different. You know, we always think, well, this person has a healthcare background, and that's their main interest. But Pam has many interests. And tonight we're going to talk about social media as it relates to people with chronic illness or with crime victimization or some other type of tragedy. And what do we do about that? Do we reach out willy-nilly? What's the most appropriate way? Because many, many people are in pain. So just want to say with that long introduction, sorry I'm so long-winded, Pam, welcome. It's such a pleasure to have you again. Welcome to Shattered Life.
Thank you so much, Donna. I really appreciate coming back on. I had a great time before, and hi to Delilah, too. You guys are wonderful, and our wonderful tag team here for guests. So I am thrilled to be back and talk about some of the intersection between resiliency and social media, which does seem to be a little disparate, but hopefully maybe we can bring together why it makes sense, why it doesn't make sense, and just kind of chat a little bit about that.
Right, right. I think it's very, very important because so many people are carrying so many burdens, and a lot of people, like myself, live alone. When you come home from work, wherever, you don't have anybody to talk to. Mm-hmm. So what do? You put it online. Is that the best way? We don't know. So before we get into the meat of the matter, Pam, for the benefit of those who did not have the opportunity to listen to your former show, although it's in the archives, so I definitely encourage people to listen. If they didn't listen, I put it up this morning. It's a wonderful show. Give us a little bit of background on your main orientation and what your main interests are and how you came to be at this intersection in your life and what we're going to focus on tonight.
Absolutely. As you said, I have many decades in the healthcare world in more traditional ways of nursing. With my graduate degrees, I have branched out into much more of the teaching role and the research role. A lot of my interests and my company, Stress Resources, we really help to build resilience in both organizations and individuals. And I say that rather broadly because everyone is different, but yet I think we can all use those skills to allow us to be to meet adversity with a little more control, compassion, and perhaps communication. And so I focus in on kind of those three C's with a fourth C of connection being really important too. And so as kind of strange as it sounds that, you know, here is somebody in healthcare who researches and talks a lot about social media, I don't think it's as separate as perhaps it initially seems. And I think we've kind of reached a tipping point in terms of the growth of social media. I think a lot of people feel very isolated, as you said, Donna, for various reasons. And we have this new way of communicating, which certainly has benefits. I think there are barriers and challenges, but we can't not pay attention to it any longer, which has been, I think, the easiest way is just pretend that this is a fad and it's going to go away. And so, you know, all my work around resilience, this is a really important component now on really observing and investigating, you know, what are some of the best practices and, you know, what are people actually doing? And is it actually building resilience or is it tearing it down and, you know, bullying behavior and everything? So I think there's a lot of meat in this whole idea of how that intersects with resilience.
Right. Well, if you were to put on your nursing and researcher hat, just in terms of backing up a bit, from the different aspects that we deal with, from like a physical standpoint, emotional, spiritual standpoint, why is it so important for us to connect with other people after we have a life-changing event? Can you speak to it from those aspects, you know, physically, emotionally, spiritually?
I think that, and that's really important to realize because when we face trauma in so many different ways, whether that's through a chronic illness, through a tragedy that has happened, through a crime, we are left with a few things. One of those is our sense of control has been impacted. a great deal. And I don't mean control over an outcome of a situation, but our sense of our place in society and a family and whatever has really shifted oftentimes when we've been impacted by one of those events. We know in studies around stress hardiness that those people who do better in all of those domains of physical, emotional, spiritual are those that are able to get their footing, so to speak, in other areas of control, of a feeling of commitment. So you need other people around you. You're committed to a cause or an idea. And seeing danger, and certainly when people have been impacted in many different traumatic ways, that sense of danger, that sense of hypervigilance is heightened. And part of the work around resiliency is acknowledging that that is heightened, but working with that sense of hypervigilance, learning some tools to bring it down a little bit, and learning a few skills of also creating more opportunities. So in a crisis, it isn't just the danger that we react to, but perhaps afterwards seeing, is there an opening? Is there a learning opportunity here? Without sounding Pollyanna about it, those people who somehow are able to capture those skills or those domains overall seem to do better in all of those areas of physical, emotional, and spiritual going on, which are things that we call, you know, quality of life measures.
Well, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And is it kind of the luck of the draw as to who might be more prepared for that than others?
I don't think it's really luck of the draw. I think that certainly perhaps certain people are more predisposed to having an easier time, but I'm a firm believer, and I've been at this long enough, that these are skills that are trainable in all of us, and that there are very few people who cannot be coached and trained into being more resilient and actually building these skills. I think what happens oftentimes is we don't really see a need to build these skills or strategies until after an incredible traumatic event has happened in our lives. And at that point, we're playing catch up a little bit with trying to build these skills at the same time that we might be working with some post-traumatic stress and the fallout from whatever that trauma happened to be. So preventative is helpful.
But a lot of times we just kind of move through life and we're going along and you think everything's okay, and then the event happens and boom, and it hits you like a ton of bricks, and then that's when you realize that you're really not prepared. So I don't know. I don't until something happens like that, whether it's a chronic illness or a crime victimization or whatever, we frequently don't think about these things. So that's why it's so important to have a show like this. It really, really is. Right?
I totally agree. I think we kind of go through life feeling pretty immune to trauma, that it happens to someone else, or somehow we are smarter than others. I think that the events of 9/11 made us all feel pretty vulnerable, and many of us were impacted directly. But in many ways, it gave our culture a bit of a wake-up call that we're all going to have a 9/11. Now, it's going to look different for each of us, but very few of us get out of this this life without experiencing pain and suffering. And so I think that we often go through life or a large part of our life with the blinders on, thinking that somehow we are going to be the ones who are immune. And perhaps 9/11 gave us all that jolt of, wait a minute, maybe I should prepare myself to be able to ride the waves a little more effectively and consciously, because I may not be able to avoid trauma in some way. I think the important thing, too, to consider is it can't be a situationally based strategy. It needs to be more global. So you don't know what the trauma or what the crisis is going to be in your life. And so whatever skills we build, they need to be able to be used in a broad way. And I think that's really important also.
Mm-hmm. Well, if people are listening now and they're thinking, well, yeah, that makes sense, what can you give us some examples of some general strategies that we can maybe see if we could implement? And certainly some of these are things that you don't have to go and cost money necessarily. It's just a way of practicing certain things, or whether do you have to go to an individual person that does the coaching to be able to do this, or is it something that you can go online, or you do
yeah.
in a small group, or what?
Well, I think that there are several ways to go about it. I think for some people, having some kind of group or even online experience with others is often very helpful, because they feel a little less alone in learning some of these skills. There are certainly some great books, online downloads, CDs available. And they're coming more, I've been seeing more and more actually being offered. So some of the studies and some of our research has shown that mindfulness-based stress reduction, which is a whole framework of learning that usually takes place over about 8 weeks, but can be done in an online way. There are some great CDs available and audio downloads. It really is integrating tools of mindfulness, which means being more aware of the present moment, dealing with pain and suffering in a rather concrete sort of way, using meditation techniques that have been shown to make some positive improvement with people. And it's now been integrated into the Department of Defense is offering for those troops, both pre-deployment and post-deployment, to learn these skills. And hopefully, well, it's still very early, but hopefully the outcome will be a lesser post-traumatic stress issue with many of our troops coming back. And so it's very powerful around trauma especially. So mindfulness-based stress reduction, and it's also called MBSR, is probably the most studied form of building resiliency currently.
Do you have a resource list on your website that people might be able to go to and say?
Actually, I will put up some sites of articles as well as websites about places that you can find people who train in that area. There's a wonderful website at the University of Massachusetts Medical School, which is in Worcester, Massachusetts. And they were the ones who really initiated this whole program called MBSR. I teach in my private practice, MBSR, but there are about 1,000 practitioners who teach this and coach people in this around the world now, and the UMass site has a listing of all those folks, and so somebody could just plug in their state or their country and find folks in their area, and a lot of them have great websites too. I'll also put up on my website, which is stressresources.com, some books and free downloads that people could also take a look at, kind of on the whole topic of mindfulness, not specifically
the great.
MBSR.
That's
so I'll put that up.
Thank you. That's very, very helpful. You know, we wanted to – now, I think we have a pretty good backdrop in terms of what it is that you do and kind of setting the scene for the topic of, social media and how this plays a role. And before I ask you about our conversation got going along these lines in the first place. Delilah, as being a publicist, I just wondered if you could share what your take is with regard to this topic, because I know you were very personally involved in doing something like this with Susan Murphy Milano, and just maybe generally from the aspect of what you do for a job. What would you say with regard to people who are struggling, and I think you found it very therapeutic in a number of ways, but just was curious if you could share a little bit.
Sure, yeah. My own personal story with social media and illness was surrounded with Susan and her cancer. She was a very public person and was very, very active online with her blog, website, all of the social media platforms. So, and over the years, she, she grew a huge fan base. So for me, when she was diagnosed, we decided that we had to have a way to communicate her progress, and to do it individually was just almost impossible. So we created a blog, conqueringcancer.me, which sort of went through day by day or week by week or month by month of her progress through the cancer, what was on her mind, what was on my mind as her caretaker, and it allowed both of us to get that information out to a lot of people and at one time, so that we, both of us weren't on the phone or writing emails or answering questions and and generally being online all the time. So we felt that it was the best way to go. Personally speaking, I felt like it was a great experience for me because it did allow me to verbalize what I was feeling, what I was going through as her caretaker, and to also, when it got to a point where she couldn't, she could no longer write and express her own feelings, I was able to do that for her. So it was quite a good experience within a bad experience for me. It showed both of us the amount of support and love that people had for her. And I wouldn't have done it any other way. On the other side of the coin, I've seen a lot of people who get caught up in the drama of things, usually people with chronic illness, I don't see that as much, but usually trauma-based occurrences, I do see it. There, I'm sure Pam can address these stages of grief and all of this, everything that comes out, whether it's PTSD or, whatever it is that particular person is feeling. And when they do make all of these things public, they just maybe don't have the sense or the tools to do it in a way that is supportive to themselves. It's more a venting, which is, I think, necessary as well. I think, you know, we have to have a place to vent. And if that particular person doesn't have a close support group or family around, then, you know, they've got to have somewhere to vent these feelings of anger and grief and whatever it is. So I see a lot of that on the other hand. And I'll let you address that. Where do we draw the line? How much is too much information to be putting into social media? And when we feel that need, where do we go?
Yeah, those are great points. And I don't think there are any definitive answers that are one size fits all. I think one of the things that is really important for those who are interested in engaging in social media or all are already there is that basically you have to realize that anything you put online is public, no matter what kind of privacy settings you have. And I think a lot of people get caught up in the immediacy and the perhaps the anger, perhaps the whatever emotion of the situation, and they tend to forget about that. I see this happening a great deal, especially on Twitter, because Twitter is a microblogging platform, really. And I think because it's kind of like messaging or texting people, often people forget the public nature of Twitter. And everything can be archived there. And so often, especially around illness, where I see a lot of people either feeling that they got hurt or it kind of takes off in a different direction are often those types of illnesses that can easily be stigmatized. So mental illness, for one. Many people feel that often others are too vulnerable to be in a public space like that. I think the person who is blogging or engaging in social media needs to understand the risks, but it may also be the only place that they can easily connect with others and decrease their isolation. So there's a balance between what's going to help them the most. But I think the very public nature of social media, we need to keep that at the fore of anything that we're going to put out there, that it's okay if somebody reads it at some point. I think that there are other vehicles, certainly, for a more reflective, private writing, and that would be picking up the pen and paper. But once we put it out there in an online forum, you know, whatever platform we're using, we have to be okay with that people will read it. In the study that I did on with my colleagues at Tufts School of Medicine, we looked at 230 illness bloggers, people who had blogged about their personal or they were caregivers blogging about the person they're caring for. And we asked them some of these questions. Number one, you know, what motivated you to put your illness out there? We also asked them if they shared their blogs, and we were only looking at blogs, with their healthcare providers. We asked them about what motivated them to continue doing this and how many comments they received, et cetera. We had some really surprising answers and results.
Oh, yeah?
That, that certainly surprised those of us who were researching it. And as far as I know,
like what, PM?
Sure. Well, as far as I know, it's still the largest study of its kind. And which kind of surprises me that nobody else has done a larger one yet. But one of the things that really surprised us is that people chose to put their blogs in very public forums. So very few people chose to have password-protected blogs or even blogging on some of the – for in healthcare, there are some pages. One is called Care Pages. The other is called Caring Bridge, which you can have very private types of communication with people. Even though it's in a public space, you have to put a password in. Very few
sure.
people chose to do that. They were on things like WordPress, Blogger, et cetera. The thing that really surprised us, though, is we thought that people would want their healthcare providers to understand some of their experience with chronic illness. In fact, the bloggers, even though they shared their blogs, 98% of them shared their blogs with friends and family, less than a third chose to share them with their healthcare provider. And when we asked why, they said they did not want to feel censored, and nor did they want to have their reality challenged in a way.
It's interesting. What do you think about that? You're surprised, right?
Me?
Yeah.
I was very surprised because our initial thought was we would teach healthcare providers all about blogging so they could have this shared experience. And then when we dove in a little deeper, what we found were the patients in some ways felt that their care might become compromised. I don't know if that would be true or not, but I think it's a very real thing. And so even though their healthcare provider could easily find them online and read about what they were writing, the patients didn't care to share that. The other thing that I was really surprised with, and this kind of goes back to Delilah's point about that information dissemination, that often that is why people start blogs. Something has happened to them. Something has happened to their family. And it is too wrenching, too tiring to constantly be answering the phone and sending out emails. And so often that is the intent initially of why somebody starts a blog, especially around an idea of something that has happened to them or a change that has happened. But what also is really interesting is if they stay at it, they transition kind of through all of the stages of loss, and they come out of it making meaning. And that's the place that we hope people find themselves, whether it's been through trauma or grief or loss in any sort of way, that they kind of work through these stages. And what a blog helps them to do, we think, is rather different than writing their thoughts in a pad of paper, because what a blog did is bring them back into the world versus it being a reflective process of more insular process.
And they're not isolated. Yeah.
And it didn't matter how many people were commenting on their blog. That was not relevant. And actually, one of my favorite quotes from one of our respondents said, first I was helped, now I am helping, now I'm back to being part of the world. And so that transition of putting the information out, gathering information from others who might have the same illness, trauma, whatever was going on, into that kind of online community and being a part of that, and then being able to help others as kind of a mentor or at least somebody who had been through similar situations, created this great sense of resilience. So there we go back and circle back to that word resilience here. So,
well, I think it's so therapeutic, you know, writing in and of itself. I, you know, as you know, I blog all the time too, and there may be something more in the future, more substantial. But can you say that the comments that you just made with regard to chronic illness, would they in general apply to people who have had or have been victimized by violent crime, or are there different things that we need to be aware of if we're switching the topic from chronic illness to crime victimization?
I think there are a lot of similarities, and why I say that is I think, as with a chronic illness, in crime victimization, there is an initial shock of an event, and you can't really make sense out of it right away. And so there's a lot of information gathering, a lot of just not understanding what has happened. And often that online space is right now one of the first places we go to when we don't know where else to go. And that happens, I think, with both. As you get more familiar with what has happened, I think there needs to be a way to express what that experience is like for you. And whether that is with a therapist, and that's very helpful for many people, in another situation with other people to talk to, that's a necessary transition. Like folks who have had a chronic illness, often when people are the victims of a crime, society isolates them and we isolate ourselves. And isolation is one of the biggest predictors for depression. And the more isolated we become and the more difficult it is to interact, the more depressed, the more it's a vicious circle of isolation and depression, and that's very similar in both. And it's not just the person who is isolating themselves. After an initial shocking event, everyone's there to help, aren't they? And the same thing with the diagnosis. But as that continues over time with the loss, the people stop interacting as much with you because they've lost interest in a way. And and so that person is extremely isolated. So not only are they feeling they don't fit into society, society is telling them that they don't fit into society.
True. Right. And so the blogging, and if they reach that point, whether you're talking chronic illness or crime victimization, it's therapeutic to continue blogging to maintain that connection and so you don't feel as isolated and whatnot. Isn't that true?
I think absolutely. I think one of the things that, you know, there may be some similarity and there may be some differences is the amount of sharing people do. Certainly with how our healthcare system is currently set up and our health insurance is tied to our employment, there are certain people need to be careful about what they might share about certain illnesses so it doesn't have an impact on their employment. And certainly that has come up in the past where people have said, you know, I think my boss read this and I was demoted. Oh, wow. And, of course, they can't directly relate it, but I think that's something people should be aware of. I think the other thing, certainly around crimes and victimization, is any legal aspects of what's happening. And I think you certainly don't want to disclose or share things that are in litigation, things that could
affect the outcome of Exactly.
Yeah. So I think you have to be very careful about those things when you are sharing your experience. But yeah. I think that's just kind of common sense and stepping back. And I always suggest also, especially around very charged topics, and this is why sometimes Twitter can become a little more problematic because it's so immediate. Certainly with blogging, I often suggest when you write a post, if it's something around a very charged subject, don't publish it immediately. Save it in draft form and reread it the next day. And if you still feel that this would be appropriate to put out there because it would help someone or yourself, then by all means publish it. But I think giving yourself a little space is helpful around very charged subjects.
Well, I was wondering if in either of those scenarios it would be good if you have a chronic illness and using, again, Delilah and Susan as the example, there's a certain point in time when you become incapacitated and you can't communicate, so the other person takes over as their representative. Mm-hmm. And so there's that trusted relationship and that person is representing what you're feeling, what you're saying. And but even if you're not in that situation and you're feeling very passionate and angry or whatever, mm-hmm. whatever it may be, I even see on Facebook crime victims using profanity and this and that.
Exactly.
And, you know, step back. Can't you just take that and show a friend and say, listen, I'm so angry about this, but how can I say this in a different way? Because I think that does a disservice and it kind of paints a broad brush picture of, oh, I'm a crime victim, so therefore I'm going to come off as that too. I don't like that. And I feel bad for those people that go on Facebook and rant and rage and use four-letter words, and I just am turned off by that. I don't even want to read it. You know,
well,
that's me.
Yeah, and I think that the thing you have to realize when you're engaging in social media is as much as you feel it's your megaphone, it really isn't. That social media is not just a broadcast medium. It really is. It should be a conversation. And in the same way, if there was somebody ranting and using profanity and four-letter words standing on a street corner, that isn't somebody that you would want to engage in a conversation with. And really where you're going in social media and why you would be engaging in it is to share your ideas, your experience, and actually have a conversation. And so I think if you think in terms of would I have a conversation with somebody if I was ranting like this, and the answer is no, then it doesn't belong in that space. It belongs
and that's
in
the
don't
world.
You think on the other side of the coin, there's a lot. What we have to remember is that there are probably the majority of social media users who are non-victims, so to speak.
Right.
And we have to remember that we're pushing out there our own pain, our own circumstances,
right.
And there's some people that they don't know how to handle that. They don't need to know how to handle that.
Mm-hmm.
So I think as we're writing, you know, anyone, no matter what the subject really, but it's particularly of our own personal tragedies or illnesses or anything like that, we have to be mindful of the people who are reading it. And compassion goes both ways.
That's right.
We would hope that these non-victim people would have the compassion to be supportive and you know, join us in our pain, so to speak. But yet there's a vast majority that don't, and we cannot expect them to, really.
I saw
a lot of very interesting things in dealing with this one particular situation, plus dealing with victimization in many other forms. I see that the victims, it's amazing to me. There's this sense that I've got to give you something back. You supported me, so now I have to give you something back, whether it be a list of resources, information, anything that you can do. And I think, you know, going back to Susan and her ordeal, you know, that's a whole other show because there's way too much information there. But in her own life, her own victimization in her own life, she was able to turn around and do so much for many others. The lives that she saved, the one that she lost, is where is the balance here? What, you know, where is it? But it's always amazing to me to see people's resiliency, as you speak about, Pam, that victims very, very often tend to want to jump right in and start giving back something to those who supported them. Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's often the motivation after that initial information gathering, information sharing time, that a blog or something like that gives back. So often, and as I said, in our study, it didn't seem to matter how many comments or responses somebody was getting back. They spent a lot of time crafting and putting out blog posts because they had a sense that this may help somebody else. And
right.
So there was a shift from that internal kind of, you know, this is what's happened to me. If somebody stayed with it long enough, there was certainly I'm giving back. This is, you know, it gave their life meaning in a different sort of, even though it wasn't something that they would have wanted, it was very powerful. And so when you talk about resilience, that's really meeting the challenge, you know, in adversity of finding an opportunity within crisis. And
there's always positive that comes out of negative.
That's right. But you can't force somebody into that space until they're ready. And so part of, I think, what's also happening in the online space that's, and this has been a rather new occurrence, are these online groups, forums, peer-to-peer, that people are finding each other around a certain topic. And it's almost like the old listservs were, but in a different sort of way, because it's an immediate chat, I've been seeing things popping up more around like Google Hangouts, where you can actually see people and have real-time video. And because all of these platforms are pretty accessible and free, and they're also on things like smartphones and tablets now, there's just such a large group that can now engage in this. So when people are really searching for somebody who maybe has had a similar experience to them, and especially in like the rare diseases, they now can have a conversation with somebody who may understand a little more.
Mm-hmm.
And that's
huge.
That's huge.
It is when you're looking for someone, especially, like you say, if it's a rare occurrence. And, you know, we have about 10 minutes left, Pam. Time's flying by. you're going to have to come back for number three.
will do.
I know. I would love you to tell the story that you shared with me with regard to how we got upon this topic with regard to what happened with the former editor of the New York Times and the op-ed pieces that were done as a result. Can you share that with our audience?
Absolutely. This was really an interesting thing, and it struck me as a kind of a turning point in terms of a recognition by those people who maybe haven't been involved in what's been going on in this online space, kind of sat up and take notice. So this happened a few months ago, and former editor of the New York Times, his name is Bill Keller, and his wife, Emma Keller, is also a journalist, and she's a columnist for The Guardian in the UK. There is a prolific blogger and tweeter, for lack of a better word, named Lisa Adams. And Lisa Adams is living with metastatic stage 4 breast cancer right now. She's a young mom in her 40s with some young kids at home. And she has been basically carrying on a conversation around the experience of living with metastatic cancer and sending numerous messages during the day, and has a very large following. Around Christmas, Lisa was hospitalized at Sloan Kettering in Manhattan because of pain, and she moved into a palliative care service, which helped her deal with pain, and was talking about this and really more of an existential type way of, you know, the meaning around this, also the joys that she was seeing in her every day. Well, Bill Keller and his wife wrote that they found this, that she basically had no dignity because she was dying in public, in a way, and sharing so much of what they felt should be a personal, private experience with death and dying. And they equated it, actually they contrasted it with Emma Keller's 79-year-old father, who they said had died with dignity, quietly, of cancer. And this raised absolutely all kinds of
havoc
on that. Especially among the folks who there's a very active, several active communities around breast cancer on social media, and how dare they, you know, talk about someone else's choices, about how they were living or dying. On top of that, there was a lot of discussion about the whole idea of stigma around death in our society, and how people are very uncomfortable with the discussion around it. But I think what was missing, and there was an awful lot, as we've talked about, of the kind of vitriol of a situation that got out of hand. I hoped, I stepped back and kind of gave it a little more of a wide-angle lens on that this is a topic that we wouldn't have even discussed 5 years ago, because there wouldn't have been that many people actually following somebody who was blogging or tweeting, in this case, about their experience, and there just wouldn't have been as much interest. So I wrote a piece for the NPR station in Boston. I'm a columnist on Cognoscente, which is one of their pages, and really saying this is why people with chronic illness, and cancer is a chronic illness, are blogging and are talking, and how wonderful that, in a way, when you have when you've been victimized by an illness, by a trauma in your life, you have stepped out of the world of the living for a while, or certainly the world of the well. And we can take away some of those barriers. We can take away disability barriers. We can take away if someone is has been scarred in some way. We can take that away, and they can just communicate with all of us without those barriers in social media. So part of this work, especially when someone is so ill, is to let them bridge over to the world of the well in many ways. And so that was what the discussion was. There is still a lot of talk about it. If people want to read about it, you just need to Google Bill Keller, and you will see pages of responses.
And I do believe we put up the link and the post that Delilah did as well, right? Because I just read that initial post,
right.
Delilah. Your op-ed as well, your response is there for all of our audience to read, and I thought it was
very good. The thing I would like to say to Mr. Keller is the fact that really there is no dignity in dying of cancer. There is no dignity there.
Absolutely.
And if that person decides that they would like to, like you said, Pam, bridge over to the land of the living for as long as they possibly can, it comforts them and, you know, it gives them that dignity. There just is no dignity in dying of cancer, flat out.
So, and we each have our own way of sharing or not sharing, and I think that's really the message around social media.
Yeah.
It's a choice. It becomes a choice, and if it supports someone in their journey as a victim, as a health issue, who are we to deny that? But we need to understand it is a public media, and how are we going to share appropriately? And and by the way, Lisa Adams is still alive and still tweeting.
Oh, okay.
So
really? Wow. All right, good for her.
So anyhow, it's a very interesting kind of case study in what this is all about.
It is. If we had to give some words of caution for people going forward, whether they're a blogger and they're dealing with illness or some other type of tragedy or victimization, would you recommend, if we're not sure about what we're writing, to run it by a trusted friend first?
Absolutely.
Or what are a couple of things that they should do? Is there anything you can...
Number one, never send anything that you... post anything that you wouldn't feel comfortable having your mother or your boss read is one
okay.
of my if you have any question about whether something is too angry sounding, too charged, I would definitely have somebody else read it first. And then my last piece would be, if you do want to write something rather provocative, and I think that there is a place for that, don't immediately send it. Allow yourself to save it in draft form and then reread it the next morning. If you still think that it needs to be sent, by all means, send it or publish it.
Well, I think that's very good advice, and, you know, just makes common sense. And these topics are so charged anyway. Can you give us some of your contact information if people would like to read your blogs and to learn more about stress resources, please?
That would be great. Thanks so much. Yeah, people can go to my website, which is stressresources.com. And I also have a Facebook page which for Stress Resources, which also is Facebook/StressResources. I am on Twitter, and my Twitter handle is at Pam Ressler, and that's R-E-S-S-L-E-R. And then my blog is on Blogger, so it's pamressler.blogspot.com.
Well, that's
and
wonderful.
I would love to connect with folks.
And I'm sure they would with you, and as we will stay connected, and I will try to do a blog to do you justice, do this show justice for tomorrow, Pam. So we just want to say thank you so much. Our time has run out. Thank you so much, Delilah, for adding what you did. It's always very touching. And we have to say good evening for now, but we will keep in touch. So good evening, everyone across the nation. Be safe. Have a nice weekend until next Saturday.